Hi folks, it's time, so I'm going to get started. I hope you've had a chance to look at the quiz previews I've sent you, because reminder again, your quiz is on Monday, and I'll add an extra office hour on Friday, so if you have any questions, you can ask them. So it's open book, open notes, open laptop, so no equations, no formula, nothing to be memorized, but you should be able to take what we do in class and apply it. So any questions from regression betas? So very quickly, let's review. I mean, you probably got the impression that I do not like a regression beta, and you're absolutely right. So I want you to help me, okay? Josh Forgy, you'd be my guinea pig on this one. What is it that I don't like about regression betas? What is it about regression betas that should make you wary? Tell me all the things that can go wrong with a single regression beta.
That's a really good question.
I ask only good questions. Do you want to pass?
Yes, please.
Okay. Teresa, you want to try? I'll help you. Are regression betas backward-looking or forward-looking?
Backward-looking.
Backward-looking. Why? Because you run the regression over the last 2 years, last 5 years. So I've given you the foundation. If you get a backward-looking number and you want a beta for the future, let's think about all the things that can go wrong. Your company could change, right? The business mix could change, the leverage could change. So the first problem with regression betas is they're backward looking. Why? Because the data is all in the past. The second problem with regression betas is they're noisy. What do I mean by noisy? What does that mean?
They don't isolate.
What is a noisy regression beta?
Inherent like and other things that affecting it, so it's hard to really pin down for the business itself, like what the risk is.
Your sound is breaking up, but I think this is what you said. By noisy, there's a big range of the beta. I might be just making up stuff as I'm going along because I couldn't hear you. But noisy basically means that when you get a beta, the beta is an estimate. It comes from the range.
Professor DeModerin?
You got a chance. Yeah.
Your audio is very murky. It's unclear.
It's almost robot-like. I suggest turning off your video for a minute and seeing if that helps.
Let's see. Very weird. Okay, let me turn off my video. Maybe that will help. Turn it back on. Is that better?
Yeah.
Okay. So by noisy, we mean the beta has a big range on it. It's got a standard error. If you got a chance to look at the weekly challenge I sent yesterday, just browse through it. It's not a big challenge. I sent you the beta for GameStop. I pulled it off Bloomberg. You know what the beta for GameStop on Bloomberg was? Did anybody get a chance to look at that beta page? It was minus 0.06. Now, do any of you think that GameStop is a riskless company? That's what the beta regression seems to be saying. It's riskless. The problem is you're looking at a slice of history where strange things happen to the company. And because strange things happen to the company, the beta reflects it. Betas measure how you move the market. So they're backward looking and they're noisy. And here's the final one. You know that Instacart is thinking of going public soon, right? It's a company that's benefited from COVID in an immense way. It's a private company still. It's thinking of going public. Let's suppose your job is to value Instacart and I asked you, what's the beta for Instacart? You can go look it up on Bloomberg. You know what you'll find? Nothing. Why? It's never been traded. We have to think of ways of estimating betas for companies where you don't have past prices. Otherwise, we're going to be stuck with private companies, with divisions, with IPOs. Backward looking, noisy, and you cannot get it for a company that's not traded. So today, here's what we're going to do. We're going to talk about what it is that truly determines betas. And I'm going to argue that betas don't come from a regression. They come from what you do as a company. So to set up the discussion, here's what I'd like to do. I'd like to show you a picture with a lot of betas on it. These were from lots of years ago. But I'm going to use this picture to kind of illustrate what it is that truly drives betas. Because with each company, I'm going to give you a beta. And then I'm going to talk about what it is that company does that might give it the beta that it has. Right? So you ready? Let's start at the very top. Bulgari, beta of 2.45. Marissa, what does Bulgari do?
What do they sell?
I'm sorry?
I don't think I've ever heard of it.
You've never heard of Bulgari? Okay. Mallory, you want to jump in? What is Bulgari?
Like luxury jewelry, perfume.
Basically, lots of useless things that nobody needs that are priced at incredibly high prices. It's an incredibly discretionary product. Let's put it this way. Nobody's died because they could not buy a Bulgari. This is not a necessity. It is an extraordinarily discretionary product. You're saying, so what? I'm going to argue that when you produce a product or service that is very discretionary, you're going to have a high beta. We'll talk about why, but that's going to be one of the things you look at. So I want to start you to start thinking about the company you're analyzing and ask, is this a product or service that is discretionary or not? Is it something that people can live without? Is it something they can delay, defer? If the answer is yes, your beta will be higher than if it's something they cannot. Let's move down the list. Quest Communications, telecom company. By itself, telecom service is a pretty non-discretionary service in much of the world. But one of the things that telecom companies all seem to share is they all tend to borrow money. Don't ask me why. It's because maybe AT&T did it 100 years ago. They all seem to borrow money in order to fund their operations. You're saying, so what? When you borrow money, you make your equity riskier. Why? Because you got to make those interest expenses in good times, which is not a problem, but you also have to make it in bad times, which is a problem. Borrowing money can make your beta higher. So the kind of business you're in matters. How much money you borrow matters. And move down the list. Let's see if we can add something to this. Microsoft beta 1.25. I've been tracking Microsoft's beta every year since the year they went public. When they first went public, their beta was close to 2. Over time, their beta's drifted down for 2 reasons. One is their business has become more diverse. Not diversified, but diverse, right? So rather than sell MS-DOS to PCs, they now sell business software to millions of businesses. And the second is they were accumulating cash along the way. You're saying, so what? Cash is an asset with a beta of 0. The more cash you accumulate, the more it acts like an anchor on your beta, pushing your beta down. So what business you're in matters, how much debt you have matters, how much cash you have matters. And finally, let's look at GE. And this is the pre-self-destructing GE. This is the GE of Jack Welch. Remember the company at Harvard Business School used to use in cases as an illustration of success? And GE, when I looked at it, was the ultimate conglomerate. It was in 26 different businesses, ranging from financial services to appliances. So I'm going to ask you a generic question. As you become a conglomerate, you spread yourself into multiple businesses. What should happen to your beta? Dan Martin, what should happen to the beta of a company as it spreads across multiple businesses?
It should go towards one.
It should move towards one, right? You're becoming like a mutual fund. In fact, GE's beta moved towards one. But one factor in GE kept the beta above one, which was the biggest single piece of GE when I did this analysis was GE Capital. You think, so what? GE Capital is a financial service arm with a huge amount of debt. And remember what we said about debt, it acts as a ballast on your beta. Let's keep moving. Below the line, you got ExxonMobil. Beta only 0.70, but other oil prices were volatile. Remember what betas measure. Betas measure how you move with the market. So let's play again. The biggest risk driving ExxonMobil's earnings and cash flows is what happens to oil prices, right? So Camille, you be ExxonMobil. When oil prices go up, is this good news for you or bad news for you as ExxonMobil?
Not good.
Oil prices, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Well, it depends because it's people are still going to use it. Are still
pensions. And you're going to sell at the higher price. So higher prices for oil companies are an unalloyed good. No oil company ever said, oh my God, oil prices have gone up. So oil prices are good for you. But Dwanish, you be an airline. While ExxonMobil is celebrating higher oil prices, what just happened to you?
I'm crying.
Yeah, because your cost. One of your biggest costs is fuel cost. You see what's happening here? Your biggest risk to you as an oil company works in the opposite direction for much of the rest of the market. Higher oil prices are good for you, but not very good for any business that uses it as an input. What does that mean? Your exposure to market risk is lower because your risk is not that correlated with the rest of the market. It moves, and in fact, if it moved enough in the opposite direction, you know what could happen? Your beta is not only just going to get low. Take a look at the very bottom of the list. What do you see? Harmony Gold Mining. Its beta is negative, minus 0.15. See, what does that even mean? When you add a negative beta stock to your portfolio, you know what you're doing? You're reducing the overall risk of your portfolio. You're buying insurance against some big macroeconomic risk. So I'm going to ask a generic question about gold, because this has always lurked in the background when you think about investing in gold. What is it that gold insures you against? What is it you're insuring against when you buy gold and add it to your portfolio? David Godless, what do you think gold is an insurance against?
Inflation.
Inflation. It, over time, when you stop trusting paper currencies, gold has been what you bought. So if you add gold to a portfolio of predominantly financial assets, stocks and bonds, you're buying insurance against inflation. And the key word is buying, right? I'm going to make you pay. You know how I'm going to make you pay? The returns you're going to make on gold are actually going to be less than the risk-free rate. You're saying, why would I do that? Because you're getting insurance. You're buying insurance. But it works only if you add gold to a diversified portfolio. If you put all your money in gold, you know what you're going to find? Tears, because this is what's going to happen. 25 years from now, when you look at your returns, you're going to have about 2% returns. You're going to bitch and moan about the fact that the world is unfair to you. But guess what? You got exactly what you need to make. You just forgot that the rest of the world doesn't think of gold as the only thing you invest in. You chose to invest just in gold. A reminder that when you use betas, betas measure risk from the perspective of a diversified investor. They're not saying these stocks, these investments are riskless or low risk. They're just saying add it to a portfolio. They're not that risky. I've left out one company, right? Altria. Or as they like to call themselves, Philip Morris. Why is the beta for a cigarette company so low? Think of the answer I gave for Bulgari and flip it. Marta, do you want to try? Why is the beta for a cigarette for a tobacco company so low? What is it about tobacco?
I'm not so sure.
What did I say about Bulgari? You can live without it. Nobody's ever died saying, hey, I didn't get my Bulgari. The essence of tobacco or any other addictive product is people cannot live without it. In fact, they probably smoke more when they can least afford it. Think of the stress you're under. You have the ultimate non-discretionary product. If you want to have a really low beta for your company, remember this is one of the questions we asked last week or last session? Try to make your product or service an addiction. It sounds immoral. Hey, you know what? If Morgan Stanley could addict you to structured products, would they do it in a second? Absolutely. Every company dreams of making its product and service an addiction. It just worked for tobacco. So here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to take the variables that we talked about and try to convert them into three specific variables. And these are the three variables that determine the beta for your company. First, tell me what you do. What kind of product or service do you provide? In the old days, you know, 20 years ago when I taught this class, I used to divide the world into cyclical companies and non-cyclical companies. You know the contrast, right? Cyclical companies tend to move up and down with the economy. Non-cyclical companies don't. So if I asked you which kind of companies should have a high, is my sound okay now? Because I think my Wi-Fi looked more stable. When you think about cyclical companies, because they move with the market, they will tend to have higher betas than non-cyclical companies. What used to be good examples of cyclical companies? Housing, steel, automobiles. What were good non-cyclical companies? Food processing. So you'd expect cyclical. But as I said, in the last 20 years, it's become more and more difficult to divide the world into cyclical and non-cyclical. Is Twitter a cyclical company? God only knows. What about DoorDash? What about Peloton? So that's where this discretionary, non-discretionary comes into good standing. The more discretionary your product or service is as a company, and again, let me emphasize, discretionary means your customers can live without it, they can delay buying it, they can defer buying it, the higher your beta should be as a company.
Professor, do you mind if I hop in with a quick question? Bulgari and Philip Morris and inflation versus gold prices. I understand product type and discretionary versus a staple as something that would have an effect on beta, but isn't that really just a regression of like salaries over time against sales, something that's backwards looking, which is kind of what we were trying to avoid?
You might measure it backward looking, but why do you even need to look at historical data, right? In a sense, if you have a discretionary product, here's how it's going to show up. In good times, people buy a lot of it, you're going to have high revenues. In bad times, guess what's going to happen? The bottom's going to fall out. This has been true as long as you've had luxury products. Gucci and Tiffany and Ferragamo do really well in good economies. You don't even need to look at historical data because you need people with discretionary income to be able to buy them. So this is not just a question of looking at historical data. It's just common sense. It's elasticity of demand, right? Nikon, we call this. So the more elastic the demand for your product, the higher your beta for a company. If you try to measure it going backwards, you have to use past data. But the fact that you use past data doesn't mean it doesn't exist, right? It is in fact based upon a very real understanding of what is it that drives my revenues. And that's what betas are based on, is do your revenues move up and down as the market goes up and down, as the economy gets stronger and weaker? And if the answer is yes, you should have a high beta. And gold, I think you don't need regression, right? People invest in gold well before there were statistics packages because they knew almost intuitively that if you had a paper currency, its value was determined by how much inflation was in it. And the less you trusted the paper currency, the more you held on to gold. So I think in a sense, in both cases, you know, past data can reinforce the argument, but you don't need it to make the argument.
Thank you.
So let me throw a few companies at you and you tell me based on what they do. I've already given you the examples on what they do, what kind of beta. Michael Brescher, let me take your company, Coca-Cola. What kind of beta do you expect it to have?
I would say fairly close to one.
Is it a discretionary or non-discretionary product?
It's discretionary to a point, but I think it's become just people pick it up as a drink.
Let's put it this way. You got to get really desperate to go down the generic cola aisle in the grocery store, right? Low price plus brand name have in a sense made it kind. So I would expect Coca-Cola to have a fairly low beta. Camille, who are you doing? What company are you doing?
I'm working on Tyson Foods.
And you can probably answer the question already. Discretionary, non-discretionary, you sell chicken nuggets at, low prices. My guess is that your revenues are pretty stable. They don't go down too much during a recession or go up. There might be other forces that I'd expect you to have a low beta. What are we looking at the New York Times? High beta, low beta? Don't think too long. Just think instinctively about what business the New York Times is, how it makes money. Two ways it makes money, right? One is through subscriptions. Subscription revenues are very stable. Why? Because you don't want to send the wrong signal to your neighbors, which is if you cancel the Times and they notice the Times is not arriving on your door, they think you're in trouble and you want that signal to get out. But that's only about 35% of their revenues. You know what the remaining 65% of New York Times revenues come from? You can always tell how well the economy is doing by just picking up your Sunday paper. It's the Sunday New York Times, just picking it up. When the economy is doing well, the Sunday New York Times will get really, really, really hefty. And the economy is doing badly, it'll get really slim. Advertising, 65% of revenues, very discretionary product, much higher beta business. So when you think about betas, think about that product or service first. That's the starting point. Any questions? Now, once in a while, you might get a product that is so super luxury. And you sell so few items of that product, you might have a really low beta. It's called it's basically a very small subset of goods. Ferrari, for instance, sells only 8,000 cars a year. It could sell 80,000 if it wanted to, but it sells only 8,000. Why? Because they want to keep this a very exclusive club. In fact, the waiting list for Ferraris is 2 years long, even in the midst of a crisis. Sometimes you can have a very narrow, super luxury business with the beta is low, but that's more the exception than the rule.
Can I ask a question?
Sure.
Unfortunately, not about Ferrari, but about the Times. I understand that advertising makes it discretionary, but what about, like, if you believe that it's just not a profitable business for the future because the whole context of what a newspaper even needs to do, whether it will exist in the future, how does that affect?
That's your cash flows, right? There are two things you control. One is your discount rate through the risk. The other is your cash flows. What drives cash flows? Expected revenues, growth rates, margins. And that's actually a good thing you opened that door, because people try to force into risk things, the worries they have about business models and revenues and growth. Right? Those are things you factor into your numerator, into your cash flows. This is all about what kind of required return would I need to make. And if your business model is shrinking, guess what? You'll still end up with a really low value, even if your discount rate is low. Tobacco business, great example, right? They have low discount rates. But what's decimating tobacco companies? The fact that we're not smoking as much. I mean, this is a shrinking business. That affects the value. So don't try to bring into risk concerns you might have that might show up as lower margins, greater competition, less revenues in the future. So let's build on this concept. I'm going to do a very simple test. Let's suppose you're looking at telecom companies, phone service. Now, if you look at the US, you look at Western Europe, phone service is pretty much non-discretionary. Everybody has a phone. If you look at Asia, phone service is still growing. I mean, people might have phones, but the amount of extra services they will buy will depend on how well or badly they're doing it. So in a sense, services that might be non-discretionary or products that might be non-discretionary in one part of the world might be discretionary in another part of the world. You think, so what? One of the things we're going to talk about is how betas can vary across the world. So let's assume, taking my argument of telecom service being discretionary in emerging markets and non-discretionary developed markets, if you just took that theme and ran with it, would you expect the betas for telecom companies in developed markets to be lower or higher than the betas for telecom companies in emerging markets? Daniel Prichard, what do you think? No?
I'd say lower.
And the argument. So this is something I want you to think about, because later when we talked about, where do I go looking for a beta for my company? One of the things you're going to look at is, should I just look at emerging markets or look at global betas? This might be one of those factors that kicks in, is what kind of product is it? Is it more discretionary in one part of the world than another? So that's my first stop, is what kind of business are you in? What kind of product or service do you provide? And start thinking about your company. Let's move to the second factor that drives betas. Tell me something about your cost structure. You're saying, what are you talking about, cost structure? Remember, as a company, some of your costs are fixed costs and some are variable costs. Variable costs go up and down. As revenues disappear, costs disappear. If revenues come back, those costs come back. But fixed costs are going to be there no matter what. I'm going to state a proposition. Let's talk about why this holds. The greater the proportion of your costs as a company that are fixed costs, the higher your beta will be. Let me repeat that again. The greater the proportion of costs that are fixed costs, the higher your beta will be as a company. Dana Hill, can you help me out here? What is it about having fixed costs that might increase the risk of investing in a company? Why is having a lot of fixed costs make you a riskier company?
Maybe because it's harder to get rid of them, like you always have them, whereas with a variable cost, you have better ability to lower them if needed?
And that's exactly, it's hard to do something about fixed costs, right? So if your revenues collapse, you're still stuck with the costs. So you're like last year, you're a hotel company, you have a lot of fixed property taxes and other costs. Guess what? You still have to pay them even though nobody's coming to your hotel. But if times are good, fixed costs help you. You know why? Because as your revenues rise, because those costs stay fixed, you get, you know, everything becomes pure profit. So the upsides become even better, the downsides become even worse. Your mood swings become bipolar, basically, with a lot of fixed costs. You just swing more. High fixed costs essentially make your earnings more volatile. That translates into a higher beta for a company. So you're two companies in the same business, and one is much higher fixed cost than the other, you would expect the company with a higher fixed cost to have a higher beta. I want everybody to be okay with that intuition, because this was a big lesson from last year, is when you look across companies, the companies were hurt the most during COVID were the companies with very heavy, high fixed cost structures, because there was nothing they could do. And that translates into a much higher beta over time. I'm not saying it's good or bad, it's just a different business model. In fact, one of the things that US companies have increasingly done better over the last 20 years with consequences is they've tried to move to more flexible cost structures. By doing what? By outsourcing, by developing business models that are much more flexible in terms of what happens to revenues also shows up in costs. That basically reduces the risk of equity investment in the company by making earnings less volatile. So one of the questions that you often face when you look at a company is, when I look at my company, whatever that company is, how will I know whether my company has high fixed cost or low fixed cost? And here's the reason it's so difficult, right? You look at the financial statements for your company. Accountants don't break down expenses into fixed costs and variable costs. They break them down to cost of goods sold and SG&A and depreciation. And you could try to guess which one's fixed, which one's, but you don't know. So if you gave me fixed and variable costs, I'd very quickly compute a ratio and said, that's your fixed cost. It's called operating leverage. The higher that number, the more you're exposed to risk. But since that number is not available, I'm going to suggest a simplistic way in which you can measure how much operating leverage your company has. Remember what I said, if you have a lot of fixed costs, every time revenue changes, your operating income changes even more, right? Everything gets magnified. So small increases in revenues will translate into big increase in operating income. Small decreases in revenues will translate into big decreases in operating income. So if I could take how much your revenues change on average and how much your operating income changes on average and look at the ratio of the change in operating income to change in revenues, I'm getting a rough measure of, are you a company with high fixed costs? Because companies with a lot of fixed costs, as I said, that ratio is going to be very high. Now, if you do this for any 1 year, strange things can happen. But what if I took across time and looked at the percentage change in those two numbers? So let's take Disney. Here I have data from 1987 through 2013 on revenues and operating income, two numbers which are very easy to pull off the financials. And I compute the percentage change in operating income every year. EBIT is earnings before interest and taxes. And if you prefer a more generic term, it's operating income. And revenues, of course, are just total sales. I take the percentage changes in each. Across the entire period, here's what I see. On average, operating income changed about 11.79% a year. Revenues changed 11.79% a year, and operating income changed 11.91% a year on average. You divide 11.91 by 11.79, you get a ratio one. You're saying, what does that even mean? 1.01. For every 1% change in revenues, operating income changed 1.01%. But during this period, there was at least one big deal that changed Disney as a company. In 1996, they bought Cap Cities, huge broadcasting company. Until then, they were a traditional theme park company that made movies on the side. So I was curious about whether that changed the operating leverage. So if you look at the numbers post 1996, that operating leverage ratio is like 1.25. It increased. So if I were to read this, and I shouldn't overread it because, I mean, there's a lot of noise in these numbers. It looks like adding ABC to the Disney, to Disney as a company, increased their fixed cost as a company. Now, I'll be quite honest. When I computed these numbers and I looked at them and I said, is that a high number? Is that a low number? I had absolutely no idea. I had nothing to compare it to. So here's what I did. I took all entertainment companies and I computed this ratio for every one of them using 10 years of data. So basically I went back and did this for, you know, there were like 50 companies for each company using 10 years of data. And the average across those companies was 1.35. So let's step back. Let's take the Disney 1.25 number because it's more reflective of where Disney is in 2013. That's what I'm getting for Disney, 1.25. The average for the sector is 1.35. Just taking those two numbers, what would that tell me about the beta for Disney relative to the beta of other entertainment companies? That it's going to have a lower beta or a higher beta? Fabian, what do you think? To the extent that you trust those numbers, what am I saying about Disney? That it's got less fixed cost or more fixed cost than the typical entertainment company?
So the operating leverage measures, it looks like it's higher.
Lower, right? 1.25. So yes. It's lower.
It's lower than, yeah.
And what should that mean for my betas? Lower beta or higher beta? If I have less fixed costs, I should have a lower beta.
Yeah.
In this case, the difference is not large enough that I'm going to freak out, but I'll tell you when it makes sense to look at the difference. Let's take a business which is almost entirely fixed cost, the airline business. I mean, think about the cost structure for an airline in a regular year. I'm not talking about a COVID year, in a regular year. Biggest single expense for an airline is those aircraft that they have to lease, right? Fixed cost or variable cost? It's a fixed cost. Once you've entered into that leasing agreement, you can't go to GE Capital which you lease, and say, you know what, guys? Nobody's flying, so I'm going to pay you 50% less. Fixed cost. Fuel costs. If you're actually flying, it is a fixed cost. Can you imagine getting on a plane, the pilot comes out and starts counting the number of passengers in the plane, 1, 2, just 5 people, then yells out of the window, there's 5 people on, fill it up halfway, let's see how far we get. There won't be 5 people left on the plane after that. Fuel costs, fixed costs. Employee costs, if you're a unionized airline, fixed costs, fix. What does that mean? If you notice, airlines never have a normal year. They're either going bankrupt or making billions. Never ever have I seen people say, oh, the airlines are just having a regular year. They know no such thing. They're either manic or they're depressed. They're either on an upswing or on a downswing. That's what high fixed costs do for you. So guess what? You'd expect airlines to have high betas. Even without debt, you'd expect them to have high betas. But for 40 years in the airline business, there's been one exception. The most written about company in the history of case studies. What's the exception to the airline business?
Southwest.
So let's think of what Southwest has done. And I'm not going to make this a strategy case. I'm going to talk purely about cost structure. It leases aircraft just like the regular airlines. But until about 10 years ago, every single aircraft Southwest had was a Boeing 737, every single one of them. You know why? Because it reduced their maintenance costs and basically kept their cost structure more under control. Their fuel costs, yes. I hope they're not economizing on fuel because I do sometimes take Southwest. So the fuel costs are the fuel costs, but they're one of two airlines that consistently hedge fuel costs. You know what I mean? Consistently hedge. They hedge it all the time. Singapore Air is the other that does it. You know what the other airlines do? They hedge it all the wrong times. They start hedging when oil prices hit 125, just as they're getting ready to fall. And they stop hedging at $30. It's almost like you have to watch the airlines hedge and do the exact opposite. You could make a ton of money in the oil price market. Fuel costs. And the reason Southwest hedges the costs is then they know their costs. That's why Southwest prices, their ticket prices, don't have the wild swings that the other airlines do, right? You don't get this deep discount followed by a huge upswing. Fuel costs, they've at least made them predictable. Employee expenses, Southwest is a unionized airline. but it's got the most flexible workforce of any airline. It's the only airline where, you know, where a stewardess has checked me on. I mean, I remember waiting at a counter, nobody, the stewardess walks by, so you're waiting to be checked on. You try that with United, you could be surrounded by stewardesses. They're all checking their job description. No, I've never checked people on. This is not in my job description. But here's the biggest saving Southwest has, less so now than when they started. I remember about 15 years ago, maybe more than that, I made a reservation to fly South. For the longest time, Southwest didn't fly coast to coast. They flew Dallas to Houston back, and you know, they did these short, they started their coast to coast. So I bought this ticket because it was cheap from New York to LA. So I didn't even check the airport until the day before the flight. So I said, where is it? No, is it JFK, LaGuardia, or Newark? I live 15 minutes from Newark. Please let it be Newark. I look, it's 9 of the 3. It says Islip. I don't mean to insult people from Islip, but I didn't even know where Islip was until I looked at that ticket. So where the heck is it? It's somewhere in Long Island. So I get to Islip, I get on the plane, nice flight, I land, I come out, and I see a big statue of John Wayne right in the middle of the airport. I said, this isn't LAX, where the heck am I? I'd landed in Orange County. And this was a pattern that Southwest followed across the country. Right? You flew to Chicago, you didn't land in O'Hare, you landed in Midway. And this is something they did across the country. And you know why they did this? If you've ever flown United out of Newark, they're in Terminal C, right? In fact, there are like 125 gates in Terminal C. And United sometimes does things for laughs, like fly you to gate 3, give you a connecting flight on 122, and see if you make it. There's some guy upstairs watching you on TV saying, he's not going to make it. Let's switch the signs on him. Those 125 gates United pays for where the one plane leaves out of. Because remember, you don't get these gates at the airports for free. You pay for them. That's a huge fixed cost. British Airways does the same thing at Heathrow. And United and Southwest early on said, we're not going to pay for all of these gates and keep them as a fixed cost. They've had to bend that policy as they've gotten bigger, but that remains a core policy for Southwest. So what does it all mean? When you look at a bad year for airlines, it's horrific for everybody else, but it's just painful for Southwest. I remember in 2002, right after 9/11, people stopped flying. There was a point in time where Southwest alone was worth more than the next 11 airlines put together. Because even though its revenues dropped, it didn't have these huge losses. When you have a company like Southwest, you know that it's less risky, and you got to figure out a way to bring in that lower fixed cost into your beta. So any questions about operating leverage, fixed costs? So we talked about the type of business you're in. We've talked about your cost structure. Let's talk about the third and final variable that determines what kind of beta you have. Whenever you borrow money, you've made your equity more risky for a very simple reason. When you borrow money, you create a fixed cost you did not have until you borrow the money, which is interest expenses. You got to make those interest expenses in good times, which is not a problem, but you also have to make them in bad times. Your equity earnings look much better in good times and much worse in bad times because you have debt. And here, I can be more explicit about how debt affects your beta. Up till now, I've talked about beta as if it were a single concept. So now I'm going to bifurcate and give you two different betas, and I'll explain what each means. The first beta I'm going to call an unlevered beta. You're saying, what the heck is an unlevered beta? That's the beta of the business you're in, whether you're in the steel business, the luxury good business, the airline business. This comes from the risk of the business and its fixed costs. That's an unlevered beta. The levered beta is the beta you see for your equity. You're saying, why would the two be different? Because you chose to borrow money. In fact, whenever you borrow money, I'm going to measure how much you borrow by looking at your debt to equity ratio, which looks for every dollar of equity, how much do I borrow? So the more you borrow, the higher that ratio is going to be. Now, one of the few advantages you get when you borrow money is you get a tax saving from interest expenses. So if you're wondering, what is that one minus T doing in there? It's like the government is putting its hand over your shoulder saying, hey, I'll take some of the pain when you borrow money by giving you a tax saving. So here's what happens. The unlevered beta is the beta you would have as a company. As you borrow money, your debt to equity ratio goes up. And as your debt to equity ratio goes up, you're going to end up with a higher levered beta. Levered betas are the betas of equity, and they reflect not just the risk of the business you're in, but how much debt you've chosen to fund that business. Now, last session, if you remember, I showed you a regression beta of a Disney, right? Do you remember what it was? 1.25. So I'm going to ask you a generic question, because we see regression betas all over. We see them in Bloomberg. We see them in Yahoo Finance. Is a regression beta a levered beta or an unlevered beta? William Clements, can you help me out here? Is a regression beta a levered beta or an unlevered beta?
Say unlevered beta.
Get a 50-50 shot, but I'd give you another chance.
Levered.
It is a levered beta. But you're saying, where the heck did the leverage come in? Because there's nothing in the regression where you put in a debt, right? You know why it's a levered beta? What is it based on? Returns on the stock, right? So if you have a lot of debt, guess what happens? Your stock tends to get more volatile. It shows up through stock returns. It is a levered beta, but the leverage that's built into that beta reflects how much debt you had during the period of your regression. The reason I emphasize that is if you borrowed $1 billion yesterday, and I'm looking at a two-year regression, that regression will not reflect the debt because it looks at the debt during the period of your regression. A regression beta is a levered beta, but the leverage that's built into the beta is how much debt you chose to have during the 2 years or 5 years of the regression. So let's make this less abstract. The regression beta for Disney was 1.25. That came right out of the Bloomberg beta page. The average debt to equity ratio that Disney had during the 5 years, and I emphasize it's a 5-year regression. During those 5 years, the average debt to equity ratio was 19.44%. Now I'm going to bring in a tax rate, and we'll talk more about tax rates next session. I'm going to bring in the marginal tax rate for Disney, the tax rate on the last dollar of income, and the marginal tax rate for Disney in 2013 was 36.1%. So let's see what we have. We have a regression beta 1.25, which we said is a levered beta. We have a debt to equity ratio during the period of 19.44% and a tax rate of 36.1%. I can actually take the levered beta and extract how much of it is unlevered, right? Remove the effect of debt. That's called unlevering a beta. Sounds fancy, but here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to take the 1.25. That's my levered beta. 36.1% is my tax rate. 19.44% is my debt to equity ratio. I'm essentially removing the effect of debt from my beta. I'm going to end up with an unlevered beta of 1.11. You guys watch Jeopardy? Classic show, right? It's a show that, you know, when I first watched it, I said, what the heck is going on? Who asks and gives you the answer first, and then you got to guess the question? Let's play some Jeopardy. I'm going to give you the answer, and I want you to guess the question to which this is the answer. The answer is 1.11. What is a good question that you could ask for which 1.11 would be the answer? And don't say, what's the unlevered beta? That's too obvious. I want something a little deeper. Jonathan Grady, what kind of question do you think would be a good one to which 1.11 is the right answer? It's the unlevered beta, but what is the deeper question you could ask about Disney to which that would be the right answer?
Does Disney reflect the industry that it's in?
One is you could ask, let me ask you a question. Could Disney have chosen to be an all equity funded company if they wanted to? Absolutely, right? There's nobody. So if Disney had chosen to be an all equity company, in other words, never borrowed money, and you say, what would the beta for Disney be if they had no debt? The answer is 1.11. The other question is the one that you just raised, which is, what is the risk of the business that Disney is in? The theme park business, the movie business, The answer to that is 1.11. The unlevered beta measures the risk of the businesses you're in, and by extension, would be your beta as a company if you chose to be in that business with no debt. You think, how many companies have no debt? When you get to your company, take a look at your debt to equity ratio. You'd be surprised how many companies have no debt. A huge percentage of companies have no debt, especially in the technology space. This unlevered beta then would be the beta for the company because they've chosen not to borrow money. Now, Disney is not one of those companies. It is going to borrow money. And the advantage of having an unlevered beta is I can now ask a follow-up question, say, hey, if Disney went out and decided to double their debt, triple their debt, quadruple their debt, can you tell me what their beta will be? And the answer is, yes, I can. And here's why. I have the unlevered beta, right? 1.11. As you borrow money, let's suppose I measure with your debt to equity ratio. So in the first column, I have debt as a percentage of total capital, debt as a percent of debt plus equity. So when the debt to capital ratio is 40%, I have debt of 40%, equity of 60%. When the debt to capital is 50%, debt is 50%, equity is 50%. In the second column, I've converted the debt to capital to a debt to equity. You know, the easiest way to do that is, Sam, if I have a debt to capital of 40%, how do I get from there to a debt to equity of 66.67?
So if you have a debt to capital
of 40%
and you want to get to the debt to equity mm-hmm. of 66%.
How do I get there?
You just need to take, like you subtract out the debt part of your capital and then you're okay.
So let's take the 40% debt ratio, right? Debt to capital is 40%. How much is equity as a percent of capital? Let's stick with the pure math. Debt to capital is 40, equity is 60, right?
Yeah.
You know what 40 divided by 60 will give you the 66.67%. If you know the debt to capital ratio of a company, getting to debt to equity is just act like your capital is 100. Divvy it up among debt and equity, divide the debt by the equity, you got the debt. You're saying, why do I need a debt to equity? Because the levered beta equation, unfortunately, is built on a debt to equity ratio. With that debt to equity ratio, take a look at what happens to my beta. When I have no debt, my beta is 1.11, my unlevered beta. When I have 10% debt, 90% equity, it becomes 1.19. As the debt ratio rises, my levered beta goes up. Take a look at what happens to Disney's beta as I get to 70, 80, 90% debt. Its beta becomes 3, 5, 7. You say Disney with a beta of 8, I'll tell you something. You give me a company and you allow me to borrow money, I can take any company and make its beta as high as you want it to with enough debt. You know what the typical debt ratio in a leveraged buyout is? Right after you do the LBO. Anybody want to guess how much? So take a look at the first column. What percentage of capital in a leveraged buyout do you think comes from debt? Dan, it's about 80 to 90% debt. So right after you do the leverage buyout, if I look at the beta for the equity investment of the company, it's going to be huge. This is like having a house without windows on a Caribbean island and you're overlooking the ocean. A hurricane is coming. It's not a question of whether, it's a question of when. And for you to survive, what do you need to do? You need to get the windows in before the hurricane hits. Now do you see why right after an LBO? What's your first priority? In fact, it becomes your only priority for the first 2 or 3 years. What are you trying to do? You're trying to pay down the debt. You sell assets. Because it's like having no windows and a hurricane is coming. If a recession hits before you pay down the debt, I don't care how well you structured a leveraged buyout, you are sunk. But with this technique, we can now estimate what the beta will be at any debt ratio. So let's summarize. You give me a company and you can take your own company. First question I'm going to ask is, what does my company do? What business is it in? Is it discretionary, non-discretionary? Second step, to the extent I can, I'm going to look at, hey, is its cost structure fixed or flexible? And I think one very simple test is look at what they were able to do in 2020, right? Because this was the ultimate test, right? Your revenue is completely shut down. I know somebody's doing Carnival Cruise Lines, and I looked at it and said, what a daring choice this was. Is the person who picked Carnival Cruise Lines here? Cody picked Domino's, nice choice, right? Because he ordered pizza, they did really well during the crisis. This, you want COVID to continue forever. Can you imagine your revenue is completely shut down? One test of, is your cost structure flexible? Is what were you able to do to your cost last year? So look at your cost in 2020 versus 2019. It'll give you a sense of how much of your costs are stuck. And the third stop, it's a simpler one because you can see what it is. You can look at debt and equity. How much leverage does my company have? Any questions about the determinants of betas? Because what we're going to do is we're going to take that, those building blocks and use it as a way of estimating betas for a company. So I'm going to state a property betas have that make them incredibly easy to work with. And this is the opening we're going to use to get around regression betas. Betas are weighted averages. You say, what does that mean? Let's assume you give me a mutual fund. And you say, what's the beta of a mutual fund? Remember, mutual fund has a bunch of stocks it owns, right? So let's say you're a mutual fund with 40 different stocks that you hold. And you say, what's my beta? The answer is very simple. It's a weighted average of those 40 stocks, betas, weighted by how much money you have in each one. If you have two companies that come together in an acquisition, you say, what will the beta of this company be after the merger? Guess what? It's always going to be a weighted average of the beta of the two companies involved in the merger. Or you give me a multi-business company, say, what's the beta of this company? The beta of a company is a weighted average of the betas of the businesses that this company is in. For the moment, you say, who cares? I'm going to use this first with an acquisition so you can see it play out. And then we're going to take Disney and think about what the beta will be based on the business itself. So this was the Disney Cap Cities ABC merger from 1996. So pre-merger, here's what the two companies look like. Disney had an equity beta 1.15 and then a debt ratio of about 10%. The total value of Disney at that time is about $34 billion. So I'm looking at the debt, the market value of equity, and the total value of the firm. So that's what Disney looked like. Cap Cities had an equity beta, which is lower, 0.95, but they had very little debt, only 3% debt. So you got a $34 billion firm taking over an $19 billion firm. So let's assume the task you were given was estimating what the beta for Disney would be after the merger. You know what you need to know still, right? You know the two companies are going to come together afterwards. When we talked about weighted average, you're saying this is very easy. The only thing I haven't told you is how Disney is going to finance this acquisition. Because it can finance it with new equity by issuing shares. It can finance it with debt by borrowing money. It can finance it with a mix of debt and equity. Now, I'll tell you how they're going to finance it in a moment. Before I do that, I'm going to do something I do in every merger before I even know the financing. I'm going to look at what the unlevered beta will be for the combined firm after the merger. In other words, I want to see what the business risk will be of the combined firm before I bring in the financing. And that's always a very good idea with these kinds of problems, is to work with the business first before you bring in the financial leverage. So here's what I did. I computed the unlevered beta for each company. So I did what I did with the Disney regression with each of the companies. So Disney's regression beta or equity beta is 1.15. Its debt to equity ratio is 10%. And the time that I did this, its tax rate was 36%. So you're saying, what's that 0.64? It's that one minus the tax rate. The unlevered beta for Disney as a company is 1.08. The unlevered beta for Cap Cities, if I remove the effect of debt from the beta, is 0.93. Is everybody with me so far? So basically, I'm removing the effect of debt from both companies, coming up the beta of the two businesses. What do we say about betas? They're weighted averages. I have the unlevered beta for the two companies, 1.08 for Disney, 0.93 for Cap Cities. To compute a weighted average, I weighted based on the values of each company. You know how I got the values? Let me go back to the previous page. Values by adding debt to equity. You're saying, why are you adding the two? Because the value of the company comes from both its debt and equity. The value of Disney is about $34 billion. The value of Cap Cities is $19 billion. So I'm taking debt plus equity is the way. So I'm going to weight Disney, $34 billion as its value, weight cap cities with $19 billion as its value. The weighted average I come up with is 1.026. I know it's an abstraction and I'm saying, so what? This is the unlevered beta for the combined company after the merger is 1.026. Now I can ask, what will the beta be after the merger by looking at how Disney finances this acquisition? But I want to make sure that you get, so I got the unlevered beta for the two companies. I took a weighted average based on the values of the two firms. Now let's bring in two ways in which Disney could have done this deal. In the first, I'm going to assume that Disney used all equity, which basically means they issued shares because that's how they bought Pixar. That's how they bought Lucasfilms. That's not how they did Cap Cities, but let's say they'd done it that way by issuing shares, all equity. Here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to compute the debt to equity ratio for Disney after the acquisition. Remember, they issued no debt. So their debt is going to stay at what it was before the acquisition, but their equity is going to jump by the $18.5 billion that they will have to issue to buy Cap Cities equity. So basically the debt will just be the combined debt of the two companies. The equity will jump by the number of shares that Disney has to issue, the $18.5 billion. The debt to equity ratio for Disney, if it used all equity to fund this deal, would have been about 8%, 7.66% to be precise. I have the unlevered beta for the combined firm. I have a debt to equity ratio of 7.66%. The levered beta for Disney, if they had funded this deal entirely with equity, would have been 1.08. There's no new debt brought on. What Disney actually did was slightly different. They decided to borrow $10 billion and use $8.5 billion of new shares. So in order to compute what the actual beta was given how they funded it, I first computed the debt that they would have after the deal, which would be the old debt plus an extra $10 billion, which is the new debt that they brought on, which means the total debt after this deal would be $13.8 billion. Their equity will increase by only the $8.5 billion of new equity. And the debt to equity ratio will be much higher after the transaction, not because they bought a risky company, but because they chose to borrow money to fund the acquisition. I know it's confusing, lots of moving parts, but here's what I want you to try as an exercise, and I'll send you the answer in the email after class today. Could Disney have funded the entire deal with debt? In other words, could they have borrowed the entire $18.5 billion? Sure, right? They had access to capital. What I'd like you to tell me is, if they had borrowed the entire $18.5 billion here, not just $10 billion, but the entire $18.5 billion, what would the levered beta have been after the deal? Try it out because it'll get you more comfortable with this levered beta equation, because even though it's open book, open notes, I mean, you want to be able to use it often enough that you feel comfortable of what the ingredients are and you can put it in and see the effect. So try that out. See what happens if they use $8.5 billion of debt. So betas are weighted averages. You can clearly use that when Disney does an acquisition. Now, clearly, if you want to do an updated analysis for Disney, you could look at the Disney-Fox merger 2 years ago. That was a big deal. Big deal in terms of you had a $180 billion company buying a $70 billion company, but the mechanics would stay exactly the same. You unlever the betas for the two companies, take a weighted average, then bring in the effect of debt into the equation. Any questions on that process? Go ahead, Dan.
So if I add something to the market portfolio with a negative beta, that's just going to move opposite of the market, which is why you're saying it's insurance, right?
Yep, exactly.
So if I wouldn't want to hold something with a beta of negative one over time because the market's going to go up over time. And that would just corrode into nothing, right?
Will the market always go up over time?
I mean, I think in the long run, do you think it would? Maybe.
There's no get. If you were certain that the market would go up in the long run, you know what your equity risk time horizon? Which would be zero. That's why I've never understood. And Jeremy Siegel, I enjoy his work a lot, but his point is stocks always win in the long term. And I said, that cannot be true, because if that were true, we would need an equity risk premium of a long time horizon. You know what, if you bought Japanese equities in 1987, you still are waiting to break even 33 years later. There is a chance, thank God it's a small chance. There is a chance even over very long time periods that you can end up losing money. And you need insurance for insurance is for those rare occurrences, right? That's the essence of insurance. That's why you're getting the insurance.
Okay, thank you.
Professor, if you don't mind, yep. It feels like the equation for levered beta involves the beta for unlevered, and then vice versa, the equation for unlevered beta involves levered beta. Can you figure out how we start, or can you repeat that?
That's what I'm going to do next, because you need something to get started, right? You're saying, where do I get the unlevered beta? That's the next step, because you're absolutely right. You need something to get this whole process started, saying, where do I start? Okay. I'm going to use Disney to kind of illustrate that process. So let's talk about how I can use this insight to get a beta for a company. If betas are weighted averages and you're a multi-business company, what am I saying? If I can give you the unlevered betas of all the businesses you're in, you can tell me what the beta of your company is. The question is, where the heck do I get those? So I'm going to lay out a process called a bottom-up beta. Sounds fancy, but it's a very simple process. And I want somebody to kind of be my, who is it that asked me about the levered beta? I couldn't see who came on. Who is it that asked me now about the unlevered levered beta?
I'm having an issue with my camera. This is
okay.
Jackson.
Jackson, okay. Okay, Jackson, you can help me out here. So let's suppose you have a company, okay? So it's 2 years out, 5 years out, you create a company. Put yourself in any two businesses you want to. What two businesses do you want to be in? Pick any two.
Let's be in fitness and healthcare.
They're too close. So fitness, healthcare and sure, maybe... Sure.
And airlines.
And airlines, okay. Airlines and healthcare, okay? And you ask me, what's my beta? Here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to find as many publicly traded fitness companies as I can and as many publicly traded airlines as I can. I should be able to go ahead and find quite a few, right? Let's say I find 100 fitness companies and 100 airlines. They're publicly traded, so what can I look up for each of them? I can look up the betas for each of them. I'm going to take the 100 airlines, get their betas, average it out. I'm going to come up with an average airline company beta and an average fitness company beta. And those betas are regression betas, which are levered. So I'm going to do what I did for Disney. I'm going to unlever the betas using the debt to equity ratio of fitness companies for the fitness beta and the debt to equity ratio for airlines for the airline beta. When I'm done, I'm going to have an unlevered beta for being in the airline business and unlevered beta being in the fitness business. Jackson, I'm going to come back to you. So now I've got the unlevered beta by looking at publicly traded companies in each of these spaces. I'm going to ask you, how much of your value do you get from each business? And your reaction might be, I don't know how much value I get, but I can tell you I get 70% of my revenues from airlines, 30% from fitness. You see where I'm going to go next? I've got the unlevered beta for the two businesses. You give me weight, 70 and 30%. I'm going to come up with a beta for your company as a weighted average. That is now your unlevered beta for your company. Now I can ask you, what's your debt to equity ratio? And if you can give me that debt to equity ratio, I can come up with a levered beta. So the long answer to your question is, the way I get unlevered betas is by having the unlevered betas for each business at my fingertips based on other companies in that space. And that becomes my starting point. Now, why am I doing all of this? Because I don't like regression betas, right? All I'm doing is replacing one regression beta with an average of 100. So Nathan, Howie, can you tell me what the benefit is of this approach where I'm averaging across 100 fitness betas? What is the advantage of replacing a single regression beta for a company with an average of 100?
Do you get rid of anything that can be going on with one company in particular?
In other words, that's a different way of saying the law of large numbers.
Yeah.
Looks hard for me. Some of my betas are overestimated, some are underestimated. I get an average that's more precise, 10 times more precise. You know why 10? Because there are 100 companies in my sample. That's really the opening I'm going to use. Is if I can get the betas for the business you're in, a weighted average of those betas will be a much more precise beta for your company than running one regression on your company and saying that's a beta for your company. So let's try this for Disney. Disney is an entertainment company, right? But it's actually very different businesses. This is my 2013 listing. I want you to think about what the 2020 breakdown for Disney would look like. In 2013, here's how Disney broke themselves down. They broke themselves down first into the broadcasting business. That's a media networks business. You know what was in there? ABC, Disney Cable. And they owned, I think, one network in India. I forget the name of the network or a substantial portion of that network, the broadcasting business. The second business is parks and resorts. And this is the easy one, right? You know what's in here? All of their theme parks. That includes Disney World, Disneyland, Shanghai Disney hadn't opened then, but Euro Disney, Tokyo Disney. And of course, if I were doing this today, there'd be Shanghai Disney and there'd be Hong Kong Disney. 2013, Hong Kong Disney had just come online. Theme parks, but Disney, for whatever reason, also includes its cruise ships. Remember, Disney owns a few cruise ships as part of the parks and resorts business. So broadcasting, theme parks. Then you have the studio entertainment business, which is their movie business. And that includes old Disney animation, but it also includes Pixar, Marvel, and a whole host of other smaller studios. The fourth business they list is consumer products, which used to be a much bigger slice of Disney. This includes Disney apparel, Disney toys. It's become much smaller over time because Disney retailing, which used to be a different, remember all those Disney stores that are all over the place, you now have only a handful left. And most of them are like fronts advertising. So you have that the Times Square Disney store, but they used to be at one point 600 plus Disney stores at selling Disney made apparel. Today, Disney's apparel business, consumer products business, mostly a licensing business. And in 2013, Disney had a fifth business that they called Interactive, which was their gaming business. The objective for this business was to turn out games for phones and computers. And Disney broke down a bunch of metrics based on these businesses. Disney was actually very good about its breakdown. Not all companies are this good about breaking everything down by business, but they broke down revenues, operating income, CapEx. So basically all the items by business. They've made my job easier, right? What am I going to try to do for Disney? I'm going to try to estimate the betas for each of these five businesses. And once I get the unlevered betas for the five businesses, I'm going to try to come up with a weighted average based on how much value I think Disney gets from each business. So I'm laying out the map for where we're going. So I'm going to start with the unlevered beta for the five businesses. I'm going to try to come up with the weights for the five businesses. And then I'm going to top it all off by looking at how much debt Disney uses to fund these businesses. So first up, I have to get betas for these five businesses. Now I'm going to take you through the actual process I went through, what's and all, because I want you to see the roadblocks I ran into and what I tried to do to get around them, because you might have to run into the same roadblocks. I started with the broadcasting business and I said, I want to look for publicly traded broadcasting companies. Now, if you think about publicly traded broadcasting companies in the US, at least in 2013, here's what you'd be looking at. You'd be looking at ABC, which was owned by Disney. NBC, which at that time was owned by GE still. CBS, that was owned by Westinghouse. And Fox, which is owned by News Corp. And essentially, there were no publicly traded broadcasting companies that did just broadcasting. They're all parts of bigger companies. Now, what do I need to get a beta for a bit? I need to find companies in that business, and I can't find them. Desperation time. So here's the first ploy I use when I run, because some of you will have the same issue. You take a company, you try to find other companies, you can't find any because they're either parts of bigger companies or there are none that operate independently. I went looking up and down the food chain, the broadcasting business. Basically, I look for, and I'll give you examples of companies I dragged into my list. Kingwood, which is a company that syndicates shows. In fact, it used to own syndicate the Oprah show, Jeopardy. It makes revenues by selling these shows to broadcasting companies. And I said, if broadcasting companies are doing well, Kingwood does well, I'm going to include it. I included Nielsen. Nielsen-based businesses, right? It measures ratings on shows. It basically is tied to the success of the broadcasting companies. So what I'm looking for are companies that do well when broadcasting does well and do badly when broadcasting does badly. You say that's stretching. Of course it's stretching. I have to get some companies that get their value from the broadcasting business. I ended up with about 26 companies. I computed the betas for these companies and an unlevered beta. And I'll come back and go through that process of how I do that by focusing on one of these businesses, the studio business. And you're going to see me go through the detail. But for theme, for broadcasting, it became companies that come out of the broadcasting business. Then I went to theme parks and I looked for publicly traded theme park companies in the US. And I very quickly realized I was going to have a problem because only two showed up. You know the two that showed up were? One was Six Flags, which is a disaster waiting to happen in terms of debt. And the other was a Cedar something. It's a Midwestern, you know, the one is a, so two companies. And I think the law of large numbers requires large numbers. And two is not a large number. Again, desperation time. And here I went global. You know what I mean by global? I said, why am I looking at US companies? Betas are betas. I can go across the world. So as an example, Lego, it's a European company, has theme parks all, you know, in big in many parts of Europe. I ended up with about 20 companies, which are theme park companies, but they were stretched across the globe. What I'm giving you is a template. When you start to do this for your company, what to do when you cannot find enough companies. Go up and down the food chain, looking for other companies in the business, or go global. The studio business, I had no trouble. I found 10 publicly traded studio companies in the US. And for consumer products, not a problem at all. There are so many consumer product companies in the toy space. I was able to find 44 companies, as well as for gaming. So with each one, I had to try harder for some than the other. So what I'm going to do is take the studio business and take you through the mechanics of what I did in order to come up with the unlevered beta for the studio business. So there are 10 companies, right? So here's what the 10 companies look like. And as you look at this list, you can already see I'm really, really stretching because some of these companies are tiny movie companies. Some are big, some are, you know, I have a huge amount of debt, some are very little debt, but they're all publicly traded. So if you look at the second column, you see the levered beta, that's just the regression beta for each of these companies. So think of sitting in front of a Bloomberg or S&P Capital IQ. I pulled up the betas for each of these companies. Those are my regression betas. Now the problem is these reflect the debt and equity that these companies have chosen to have. Something Disney might choose not to. So for each company, here's what I looked up. I looked at the market cap of the company. That's the market value of equity. I looked up the debt they had as a company. And if you add the market value of equity to debt, you have what's called the value of the entire firm. So basically with each company, I'm pulling numbers for that company based on the market value of the firm, how much debt it has, as well as how much cash. And you're going to see in a minute why I care about all three. So 10 companies, I have the beta for each one, the market cap for each one, the debt for each one, and the cash for each one. Now I could compute an unlevered beta for each company. Right, because I have the numbers now to do this, because all I need to do is compute the debt to equity ratio and do it. But I'm not going to do that. I'm actually going to take these companies and compute a beta for the entire sector. The average beta across these companies is about 1.35. So it's just a simple average of the 10. I said, this looks good. Let me work with the average. Then I tried the average debt to equity ratio. The average debt to equity ratio I got was 129.33%. And I said, that can't be right. Movie companies don't borrow that much money. Why am I getting such a high debt ratio? And I looked up the column and you could see why, right? There are two companies which are disasters. Huge debt to equity ratios. They're on the verge of bankruptcy probably. They're pulling up my average. Maybe a statistics class and you have outliers that are messing with the data. There are two things you can do. You can remove the outliers, which I don't like to do because then you're playing this game of which are my outliers. And before you know it, your sample size goes to one. Or you can leave the outliers in there. median. A median is the 50th percentile, halfway up the data. It's not going to be affected by outliers. And I use the median because there's no financial theory behind it, because statistically it works better for me. The median beta for these companies is 1.24. The median debt to equity ratio is about 27%. So I have a median movie company, a median debt to equity ratio. And in fact, if you want to think about it, one way to think about these betas is to think in terms of a financial balance sheet. This company is about 21, I mean, the typical movie company is about $21 of debt and $79 of equity, 21. So that's their typical breakdown. But they also have about $3 of cash and $97 of being in the movie business. My objective is to get a beta just being in the movie business. So I'm going to go through two steps. It's going to be a little messy, so hang in there. First, I'm going to unlever the betas. So basically I take the 1.24 levered beta. I use the 27% debt to equity ratio. I come up with an unlevered beta of about 1.07. So if you ask me, what's the unlevered beta for a movie company? My answer, it's about 1.07. But a typical movie company is 97% movies, 3% cash. You see, big deal. Remember, the beta for cash is zero. If I want a beta not for a movie company, but just the movie business, that 1.07 that I just gave you is not the right beta for that business, because it's pulled down by having cash. It's a very simple adjustment. Here's what I do. I take the 1.07 and I take out the cash. So basically I'm dividing by the 97% that's just movie business. I end up with an unlevered beta for being in the movie business of 1.10. I know it's tedious, but with each grouping, that's all I did. I started with a regression beta. I unlevered the beta using a debt to equity ratio. I cleaned up for cash by taking out the effect of cash. And if you go back to the previous two pages back, that's the beta that I report for each of the five businesses. The best way to do this is to actually try it out on a group of companies, take the average beta, clean it up, because you're trying, this is called a pure play beta. You're trying to get a beta for being in the five businesses. Let's do one final thing and we'll end for the day. I want a beta for Disney as a company, right? I've got a beta for each of the five businesses. To get a beta for Disney as a company, I need to take a weighted average. Now, if I'm in a hurry, here's what I can do. I can take the revenues which they've given to me by business and weight each business based on revenue. So if they get 20 billion from media networks, then say that's how much. But when I do that, I'm acting as if a dollar in revenue in one business is equivalent to a dollar in revenue in every other business. And that might not be true, because margins are different in different businesses. Growth is different. So when I computed the betas for each business, remember I pulled up the 10 studio companies? If you go back two pages, I also computed, if you look at the very last column, a ratio called enterprise value to sales. EV is enterprise value. That's what the market is paying for each business divided by sales. You look at the very bottom, it says 3.05. You're saying, what does that even measure? A typical movie company trades at about 3.05 times revenues. And I do this for every one of my five businesses. I look at what multiple of revenues companies in that business trade for. And if you look at the second column, that's the 3.05 right there. So here's what I do as my final step. I take the revenues, I multiply by that ratio. I come up with an estimated value for each of the five businesses. So all estimates, I'm building on estimates on top of estimates, but based on my estimates, here's what I see. Disney is about 49% broadcasting. It's about 34% movies. It's about 34% theme parks. It's about 13% movies. This was in 2013. 2% consumer products and 1% gaming. The weights all are obviously add up to one. But the weighted average, so if I take the unlevered beta and weighted by these proportions, what I get as a beta of 0.9239 is the unlevered beta for Disney as a company. So Jackson asked that earlier question. It's a very good one. When I need a levered beta, I need to get the levered beta, I need an unlevered beta. He's saying, where do I get that? Go to the businesses your company is in. Get the unlevered betas of those businesses. Take a weighted average. You got the unlevered beta of your company. Then use your debt to equity ratio to come up with the levered beta. Now, of course, Disney has its own cash balance. If you ask me what's overall beta for Disney as a company, including its cash, it's going to be a little lower because cash has a beta of zero, but that 0.9239 is the beta of the five businesses they're in. So take a look at this example. I know there are a lot of moving parts, and I went through multiple steps that built on top of each other, but get comfortable with it because it is the way you're going to get a beta for your company. You're not going to use a regression beta. That's why I said, don't spend too much time finessing the regression beta. This is what you're going to do for your company. And for some of your companies, it'll be easier than others. So when Michael computes a beta for Coca-Cola, it'll be mostly beverages. But if you're doing the beta for United Technologies, it's going to be trickier. And with a company like Peloton, you'll have to make some judgments. Who's doing Peloton? Somebody's doing Peloton, right? Nathan, are you doing Peloton? Oh, Mari, you're doing Peloton?
Yes, I'm doing Peloton.
Okay. What business is Peloton in?
I was actually just wondering that as we were talking about this. I'm not sure
when it went public, what was it market? What was it marketing itself as? An equipment company with a very, very premium subscription model, right? $40 a month. You know what COVID has done to Peloton? My wife would never pay $40 a month ever for any subscription, but she has a Peloton subscription, but the $13 one, she loves it. Their business model is now more fitness subscription and less equipment. It's still got an equipment component, but one of the judgment calls you'll have to make is when I look at Peloton, how much am I going to treat them as a fitness equipment company, whether comparables are going to be companies like Life Fitness and Nordic Track and all those other fitness equipment companies, and how much of their business is the subscription business? And I'm not sure whether that's even healthcare. Is it entertainment or is it healthcare? I don't use Peloton, so I couldn't tell you. But there are layers of judgment that you will have to make that might determine what kind of beta you give your company. Carlos, last question, then we'll end for the day.
Yeah, sorry, this might be a bit of an ignorant question, but when we're doing this analysis, should we just research online to find the tax rate, or is that something that's usually available?
This is the marginal tax rate. That's the advantage of marginal tax rate. All U.S. companies, the marginal tax rate is 25%. Okay. In fact, if it's in a different country, you go to my website, I have marginal tax rates by country.
Thanks.
Okay. I will see you Monday. There will be class on Monday after the quiz or before the quiz, depending on when you take the quiz. Probably be after the quiz. But it'll be a 1 hour class. I'll cut off 20 minutes. It's my concession to having the quiz on the same day. But I'll see you on Monday. Take care.
Thank you.
Thanks, Professor.
Bye-bye.